Welcome to this episode of Real Space Strategy. I'm your host, Christopher Stone, Senior Fellow for Space Deterrence and Warfighting at the National Institute for Deterrence Studies in Washington, D.C. Real Space Strategy exists to provide you, the listener, a reality check on U.S. space policy and strategy, while giving you insight into the processes required to achieve a credible deterrent and warfighting posture for the United States Space Force. The views expressed by the host and guests in Real Space Strategy are those of the host and guests and are not to be attributed or considered part of any government entity or private sector company. Well, for this episode of Real Space Strategy, we're going to do something a little bit different. We're going to talk about a historical figure that has been mentioned in the news of late. A New York Times article came out recently that talked about a commentator on space and science fiction from middle of the last century, a guy named Willie Ley. And a lot of you may not know who he is, which is why I thought it would be a good time to bring the only biographer that I could find on Willie Ley. And he wrote a book called Willie Ley, Prophet of the Space Age. And for those of you that are interested and are fellow nerds like me, as well as professionals, you will recognize some of the names that have said nice things about the author and the book. Michael Neufeld and Roger Lanius in particular are two guys that used to be big with the Smithsonian Air and Space Museum. They've written their fair share of great books about historical figures in American space programs, such as Wernher von Braun and things of that sort. And so what we're going to do is just go a little bit, learn a little bit about Willie Ley, and then I'll get into, toward the end of our time with the author, what was in the news about Willie Ley in the last couple of weeks. So without further ado, the author is Jared S. Buss, and he is obviously the author of Willie Ley, Prophet of the Space Age. So Jared, thanks very much for being with us.
Well, thank you for having me. I'm excited to be here.
Awesome. So yeah, this is something that our podcast normally talks about, as the name implies, a lot about space strategy from a national security perspective, sometimes some exploration. But every now and then we have a nice history chat, and we've talked about various historical figures like General Power, General LeMay, things of that sort that you probably heard of that have some connection with American space power and space activity. And when I saw that newspaper article in the New York Times, which we'll get to a little bit later, I thought, hey, Willie Ley is a pretty big deal for folks who have been reading about space for their whole life like I have and have been into the space profession for over 20 years. And while you and I are familiar with who Willie Ley is, could you set the stage for our discussion today with a brief summary of Willie Ley's bio, where he was born, when he came to America, things of that sort?
Sure. He was born in 1906 in Berlin. He came to the U.S. in 1935, kind of as a refugee. But in both Berlin and post-war America and pre-war America, he forged a living as a science writer, as a public lecturer, and really as someone who wrote on all kinds of scientific topics, not just space travel. He would eventually publish over a dozen books and, by my estimate, over 1,000 articles for various magazines and newspapers. So I would describe him mostly as a science writer. That is what he did for a living, as a writer. But he was on TV, radio, giving public lectures in auditoriums and rotary clubs. He was everywhere. But he is best known to the spaceflight community as the popularizer or the go-to rocket expert of the 1950s. So even though he isn't as well remembered today, he was quite famous in his day and time for what he did. I would consider him one of the most, if not the most, influential science writer of the 20th century, particularly in the American context. There are, of course, some names that come close, like Carl Sagan, but he was just so prolific and influential and deserves the title of a prophet of the space age for how much he inspired Americans to dream of a future of rockets into space and interplanetary travel.
Yeah, well, that's how I obviously know him, and I remember watching some old TV programs with him in it, which we'll get to in a minute. But so I'm curious, how did a kid in Germany, before even, you know, decades prior to Sputnik and the beginning of the space age, How did he end up becoming interested in space flight? Was this something that he always liked? Was he a big reader in science fiction or something? Or was there something in particular that sparked his interest?
Well, there's not a lot known about his childhood and his teenage years. What is known is that he grew up, in his own words, in the Museum of Natural History in Berlin. So he would move from libraries to the museum on weekends, researching every nook and cranny of that museum, and then he would do research on fossils and artifacts, and then he would consume lots and lots of travelogues, travelers' tales, exploration and adventure tales, and to some extent he consumed early German science fiction, which wasn't very widespread, but there was, say, Captain Future, and Kurt Lotzwitz's On Two Planets. That was his favorite science fiction novel. But he was always interested in science, exploration, and natural history. And that is when, at the age of 20, he discovered a book on space flight. And from that point on, in his words, the space age began. And he began writing books, not only about rockets, but also about dinosaurs and natural history. And his career went off from there, first in Germany as a very young man during hyperinflation, and then in the United States later. Many accounts say he studied at the University of Berlin and later Königsberg. I don't think it's accurate to say he was an enrolled student, but rather just a clerk who worked at a bank who studied natural history at night and took some night classes at the university. So he very much saw space travel and space exploration as a new frontier and an extension of older frontier legacies, older fascinations with exploration and discovery and knowing the world. He was very much a romantic in the long tradition of German romanticism and popular writing. So space was just a natural next frontier for a young man who was always interested in frontiers and exploring them as a curious mind and as a human who was just very much thrilled with the wonders of the world and the connections that could be made to a broader cosmos out there. So space was just a natural extension of his love of science and exploration.
Yeah, so I was curious when you gave him the title. I guess he had been called this for a while, by the time he died, the prophet of the space age. What are some of the things that he sort of predicted, and what did he base his predictions on?
It could be quite technical. When he discovered a book on rockets in 1926, he consumed the book only to find out that the book was popularizing an obscure Romanian professor named Hermann Oberth, who had published his failed doctoral dissertation by rocket in interplanetary space in 1923. He immediately got Oberth's treatise and dove into it. It was technical, it was full of calculations, but he studied those calculations for days until he fully understood the science. So many of his later predictions were always based on science and theories and new discoveries. But sometimes there was just a fundamental belief in the questing human spirit to solve problems. If there was a problem, it could be solved, even if they did not know how it would be done. He had a faith that human beings would figure out a solution to a problem and overcome it in a step-by-step way.
How did he end up partnering with Disney and Wernher von Braun? I'm assuming that by the 1950s, he was pretty much considered an expert in his field at this point, even though he didn't necessarily have a college degree. He was just a self-taught guy who took night classes, like you mentioned, and he did a lot of writing, prolific writing. How did that end up happening with him and Wernher von Braun working with Disney? Was that something
Well,
he did, or was that something somebody else brought him into?
I think his relationship with Von Braun really began in the early 30s when Von Braun showed up to his home as a young student, as an 18-year-old student, and Ley introduced him to the Society of Space Travel, Society for Space Travel in Germany, which was getting strong at that point, and Ley was its chief publicist. So they have a history going back to about 1930, when Von Braun became interested in the circles of engineers that were working on liquid fuel test rockets and models. But after about 1931, Von Braun kind of disappeared from the scene into more military secret operations, and Ley was on the publicity side. So they were never very close as acquaintances. And when the V-2 rocket began to fall in 1944, Ley did not think Von Braun was responsible for the V-2. He thought Hermann Oberth was. But they did have a reunion in 1946 where they talked about rockets and they talked about the Society for Space Travel, and they talked about the research site known as Rocketport Berlin, where they had worked together. And they reunited at a time when Project Paperclip was happening. And from that point on, they became acquaintances. They would give public lectures together and do many things together as professional accomplices. But when it comes to Disney, I think the real impetus for Disney was a period in really starting 1949 when Ley published a best-selling coffee table book called The Conquest of Space. It was heavily illustrated by Hollywood artist Chesley Bonestell, who has gone down as the father of space art in the 20th century. He did the illustrations and Ley wrote the text, and it was a best-selling book that inspired the editors of Collier's Magazine to run a very famous mini-part series on space, with the first issue being Man Will Conquer Space Soon, and that magazine had a publication in the millions of readers. And it convinced convinced illustrator Ward Kimmel at Disney. It inspired him. He was very fascinated that the scientists like Von Braun and Ley and Hoebner were all writing not just about the eventual conquest of space, but about the immediate conquest of space, that it was something that would happen within their lifetimes, possibly in the next decade. So the Collier's series was very influential, and the story goes that Disney himself was, as he was designing the different parts of Disneyland, which included Frontierland and Fantasyland and Main Street USA, he had a fourth part of Disneyland called Tomorrowland, and he didn't really know what to do with it. So the legend goes that he handed Ward Kimmel, a blank sheet of paper and said, "You're a futuristic thinker around here. You pay the bill." At which point, Kimball called and contacted Ley. Ley worked with Disney for 3 months before ever filming the Man in Space TV special. And then they also brought Von Braun into the picture a bit later, where they both appeared in the first TV special. I don't think the impact of the TV special can be underestimated. It was a TV special that got an audience of 40 million people at a time when only 35 million American households had a television set. So it was widely viewed, not only it, but the other two parts of Disney's program. And it was rebroadcasted many, many decades after the fact, and it was shown in movie theaters. So it was a quite remarkable television special that took American audiences into space, onto the moon, and to Mars in a very educational and informative way, even though there were comedic moments. The television series also got translated into school films and school library books for junior high. So they got involved with Disney really after Disney was catching wind of a fad that was happening, of an explosion of space-related media at the time, which not only included the work of Lay, but things like Tom Corbett's Space Cadet and other magazines and science fiction movies. The space age in the early 50s really was exploding in popular culture, and I would credit Lay to a large extent with making that possible.
Yeah, so I can tell you, for those that are interested, you can buy this on DVD and Blu-ray. I actually have a copy of the entirety of the series, of all the different parts. And my kids, who are little kids, but they love that show and they want to watch it over and over again. Some of it because of the goofy cartoons with it, and others just because of the explanations of things that they've seen. Now, for those who may not know what our guest meant when he said paperclip, Operation Paperclip was when, at the end of World War II, Von Braun and his team surrendered to the Americans as they were invading Germany, and they surrendered themselves and their knowledge over to the Americans. They got moved back to the United States, first into the middle of nowhere in Texas, and then eventually to Huntsville, Alabama, with the Army Ballistic Missile Agency and things of that sort. So that's what he was talking about there with regard to Wernher von Braun and his team. And then he became an author, like he said, of all that. I'll also mention one thing you mentioned, the space artist, Chesley Bonestell. And the cover of your book has a very nice picture from him on there. I think this is the one, if I'm not mistaken, is like a view from Titan, mm-hmm. of Saturn. And which is kind of going to be fun because NASA is supposed to launch a mission in the next couple of years to Titan, where they're going to land on Titan. So it'll be interesting to see how close he was, because we could tell from his lunar pictures that he wasn't too far off, even though obviously nobody had been there. So, but back to the topic, you had mentioned that you said that the Disney programs had a lot of influence. And I was wondering what kind of an impact on the American people do you think it had? I know I've read some other people who credit that program as part of, and of course the magazine articles and stuff like the Colliers and things that got them mentally ready and excited about manned spaceflight in particular and all the other stuff that started up around the late 50s, early 60s. What kind of impact do you think it had, and why do you think that impact started to wear off after a few decades?
I think it's impossible to quantify the impact of specific media representations, but there's no doubt that the space age really exploded in popular culture in the early 50s, and it survived intact really a short period of time after Apollo 11. But there were just so many different magazines, so many different publications, that it related, I think, to Lay's chief philosophy here, which was, in order for something to become an engineering reality, you have to inspire people to believe in it, especially when it comes to space flight and rockets. That once the public believes in something and is willing to fund it or support it or consume it or participate in the active dreams, those engineering dreams can become a reality. It was very much a vision of science and engineering where the patron wasn't just the government, but the patron was the public. And public support could lead to amazing things if politics and other obstacles got out of the way of engineers. If engineers could inspire, especially a new generation of children who would become the future dreamers and the future engineers, then those dreams could become realities. So I think it's impossible to quantify the impact, but there was just so much going on prior to Sputnik in terms of space-related media and other types of influence.
I know you mentioned inspiration, and one of the things that I'll get to a question on that in a minute, but before I forget, you mentioned Apollo 11, and I had read in one of the articles that had come up recently about Willie Ley in the New York Times was that he died of a heart attack right before he was going to travel to watch the first lunar landing. Like NASA was going to invite him in, and they were going to probably give him a royal treatment. Are you familiar with what the plans were with regard to Willie Ley and the lunar landing? Obviously, he had a heart attack and died before then, not too long before then, if I remember right. I'm just curious what you know about that, if anything.
I do know, according to his obituary in the New York Times, the science writer for the New York Times was corresponding with Ley, and he had been invited to go to the Texas Space Flight Center to witness the lunar landing, which was later renamed the Johnson Space Flight Center. He had planned to go, but he developed health concerns just weeks prior. So he remarked that he may have to participate in the launch the way that all Americans were, which was glued to their television sets and witnessing it through media. But he made a comment that in some ways he was fine with that because that's what made it possible. So I do know that he would have been an honorary guest, and there's no doubt he would have been one of the highest honorary guests at the event, alongside engineers and other people who had done so much to make that dream become a reality. It wasn't long after his death that they named a crater on the moon in Ley's honor, on the proverbial dark side of the moon, which just shows how much of an honorary guest he would have been at that launch.
Yeah, I bet. Then that has to stink. I don't know. I don't know anything about other than what I've read about his family and what they may have thought about that. I know that if anybody's interested and you want to watch the launch, you'll see all sorts of really famous people. Charles Lindbergh was at the launch of Apollo 11, Johnny Carson, former vice presidents, generals, you know, pretty much anybody that was anybody was there for that to watch the liftoff. Now, I'm going to get into the article a little bit and then into some present day stuff. So as you might have seen, as I've alluded early on in the podcast here, the New York Times had an article about how somebody found his cremated remains in a New York City basement a few months ago. And sadly, nobody knew who he was, and the people of the building had to look it up with the help of a New York City museum. And they didn't know really what to do with it because he didn't have any apparently living relatives to pass it on to, which to me makes no sense why it would be in a basement and not with the family. But I was curious if you have any ideas or speculation as to how in the world that could have happened. I mean, this pretty high profile guy dies, he gets cremated, and then 50, 60 years later, they find his remains in a basement in New York City. So I'm curious about how his family didn't have that and all that. Is there any family dynamics maybe that might explain some of that? Or I was wondering if you had any speculation on that.
Well, I can only offer speculation, and some of it's based on comments left by readers on the New York Times article, as well as the comments on people.com. But there are folks who claim to be porters who worked at that building who said that Olga Ley lived there in apartment 5G. I never followed his family after his death, so I can't confirm that. But the working theory that the internet has right now is that Olga Ley lived in 5G. It was leased under the name Parker, which was his daughter's married name, Xenia Ley Parker. And she was quite successful and possibly moved her mother to the Upper West Side out of Queens before her mother died in 2004. One person in the comments section claims that he was there when one of the daughters came for the deceased mother's things, but the daughter did not want to take the ashes. I have no idea why or whether or not that's true, but that seems to be the internet's working theory right now. But again, I never really followed the family dynamics after his death, and my biography was never really a truly a personal biography, but more of a professional biography of Lay. So I can't say whether that story is true or not.
No, that's fine. That's still some interesting speculation, because one of the other things that the article mentioned was that, I guess, not long after he died, Popular Mechanics put out an article or their own version of an obituary or something, and they suggested that his ashes, or at least some of his ashes, be scattered on the lunar surface in one of the future Apollo missions. And I think either the curator of the New York City Museum or somebody was saying, hey, that'd be a pretty good idea of what to do with this great visionary science author and inspiring person for the space age, to, you know, have his ashes scattered on the moon. And I have no idea. The article didn't mention that they were working toward that or talking with NASA or SpaceX or anybody, but I was just curious, as the author of his professional biography, what do you think about that idea? Would that be something that you think he would probably approve of?
I've thought a lot about this, and on the one hand, I would say yes, of course. Everyone who remembers Lay will remember him for space travel and for the tragic consequences of having a crater on the moon but dying prior to the moon landing, and everything he did to inspire people to dream about rockets and space travel. Space just seems the obvious resting place. And I think it would be the easiest GoFundMe in history if they just had to raise $15,000 to get a small amount of his ashes to the moon. I don't know the logistics of getting it to the far side of the moon to his crater, but getting just a small part of his ashes to the moon would be a fitting tribute. And on the other hand, I feel like he wrote so much about the wonders of the world. He loved the Arctic. He loved the sequoias. He was enchanted with jungles and deserts and just natural landscapes and mountains, that there's any place in the world except cities that he would be home at as his ashes. Because I think, even though he's best known for his work on space travel, some of my favorite books by Lay have to do with natural history and exploration of the world and the mysteries of cryptozoology. So he could be anywhere except a modern industrial city. But I think the easiest tribute that most people would agree with is get some of him into space or to the moon.
Yeah. So let's move a little bit to the present day, because this, I think, reading about Willie Lay and doing the stuff that I do both on this podcast and in my writing and in some of my other jobs in the space world over the years has made me think. So one of the things I got to help out with a few years ago was the helping establish the Space Force. And one of the things that a lot of us career space guys were into is, you know, science fiction has been typically a motivator for a lot of technological advancements. People dream about it, they write about it, and then they try to make it happen, or the people who read their thoughts try to make it happen. And one of the criticisms that a lot of people give to the Space Force and the people who advocate for the Space Force, typically people who aren't space people, say, you need to knock off with this science fiction stuff. It's not real. Nobody cares. Why don't you just focus on the main thing that you're doing right now, which, of course, is boring. And a lot of people have great visions of what the Space Force could be and should be, which, by the way, a lot of them are similar to what some science fiction authors in the 50s and 60s were dreaming of a Space Force. There was a cartoon strip called Skymasters of the Space Force that I didn't even know existed until I was doing some research on my own regarding this. And so a lot of the names of Space Force organizations, either their acronym form or their names, have some roots in science fiction, like Starcom, which is a training command in Space Force. But StarCom was also an 80s science fiction cartoon. There is SPOC, which is Space Operations Command, but its acronym sounds like Spock from Star Trek. And so a lot of these non-space professional people like to throw shade at the Space Force for this. And one of my arguments has been, hey, even in the Air Force, you know, there was Leonardo da Vinci, there's all these guys who were dreaming about flying airplanes and what you could do with an airplane. So there's no difference really from that in space, given the fact that a lot of this science fiction authors like Willy Ley and others helped lay the mental and emotional and maybe even technological framework for what later happened in the 50s, 60s, and up to today. Why not use a science fiction or a visionary approach to motivate people to participate and engage in stuff, something like the Space Force? What would you say to these naysayers? And what would Willy Ley possibly say to these naysayers who say that science fiction stuff is useless, it doesn't do anything to help you?
I think Ley would credit science fiction as inspiring people to believe in a dream. And when they believe in that dream can become a reality. And it's the unfortunate reality for NASA and other space organizations that Americans want a heroic explorer. They want an adventurer. They want manned spaceflight. But the dilemma is always that space is just so big. And even though in my lifetime we've discovered so much through Voyager and unmanned probes, it's been amazing discoveries, but they haven't necessarily excited the public nearly as much because there is not a heroic explorer on board a wagon train to the stars. But with regards to the science fiction authors, I think they have a pivotal role to play in that they inspire ideas to circulate, they inspire people to dream, and they offer some blueprint of the future, which can be futuristic in terms of very far away or realistic in terms of not so far away. I think they deserve a lot of credit. NASA has always had a hard time inspiring people the way that science fiction inspires, which may be partly to explain why the first space shuttle was named Enterprise and the crew of the TV show was on present to give it. NASA has had a long history of trying as best it can to use science fiction or co-op science fiction. But in some ways, science fiction always has its own role to play in letting people virtually witness the space age before they actually witness the space age.
Right. I agree. I personally am guessing, and you can tell me if I'm wrong, but one of the big arguments back in the 50s and 60s regarding the man versus robotic was that man has to play a role. Obviously with the Wernher von Braun designs, you know, there wasn't as much computing power. There wasn't this AI stuff that we're starting to deal with more. And so there was a lot bigger crews and things of that sort. And as technology got better and miniaturization happened and computers got better and a lot of that remote stuff kind of became more of the safer option, there really was no substitute for having a man or a person engaged in it. And I personally am concerned that a lot of people are so concerned about playing it safe that the adventure part of it, as well as just having an actual person involved. I really think that if the Space Force had manned related missions like the Air Force does, I think they would have no problem filling those slots. And I personally think that I'm trying to remember the person. Oh, I think it was John F. Kennedy was talking about how, you know, it doesn't matter how precise or advanced the computer is. The human brain is the most advanced computer there is, and they should always be involved or something to that effect. I'm curious what you think he would think, Ley would think about people wanting to play it safe and save money and not send as many people out. There are people who are even talking about sending an astronaut out to the moon only to do remote control rovers from orbit rather than going down to the surface again. And I know a lot of friends that I work with are like, that's pretty lame. But I'm curious, what's your thoughts on that?
I think Lay would, he was always in the classic model of an exploration needed an explorer, whether on Earth or in space. And the heroic explorer and adventurer was someone to idolize and to respect, and the journey was something to respect. But I think he would be very amazed and very pleased by the discoveries made by unmanned vehicles. And it's just a classic dilemma where in some ways the problem isn't the man versus unmanned. The problem is that space is just so big. Mars is 28 million miles away at its closest. There's very little reason to believe that a manned landing on any other planet would, well, except for moons, would be feasible. And the nearest galaxy is 4 light years away, which incidentally Leigh and von Braun believed that there would be a manned journey to Alpha Centauri by 2014, which they were wrong about. But even then, it was a vision of the future that involved human beings going someplace, not just sending back data from probes. So I think he would really appreciate the discoveries, but I don't think he could ever let go of that vision of a heroic explorer or a heroic astronaut who trek through the cosmos the way that an adventurer trek through the jungle to discover unknown things. I don't think he could ever let that go, and in the same way, many in the public can't let that go. And the fault is somewhat that the universe is just so big and daunting that we can land on the moon, and we could possibly land on Mars someday, but then where else do we go?
Well, I have a long list of places we could go, but unfortunately we're now out of time. But I wanted to thank you again for joining us, Jared. And again, this is the author of Willie Lay, Prophet of the Space Age, the professional biography of Willie Lay. And thank you again for being here. I appreciate your time.
Well, thank you for having me.
And this is Chris Stone for Real Space Strategy. Thanks, everyone, for joining us today. You've been listening to Real Space Strategy. Real Space Strategy with Christopher Stone is a production of the National Institute for Deterrence Studies. And for more information, see us at our website, thinkdeterrence.com. That's thinkdeterrence.com, our YouTube page, and any of our various social media sites on whichever platform you choose.
The NIDS Podcasting Network.